welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Thank you so much for joining us today. In the second part of today's show, Dave Thompson, our news director here at Prairie Public, he and I will review the news of the week. And Matt Olean, our movie reviewer extraordinaire, will stop by the Main Street studio. Matt reviews the movie Nickel Boys. He also reviews the recently completed Fargo Film Festival and previews an upcoming film series that he's hosting. But we begin today's Main Street with our monthly philosophical currents discussion, led by Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein from the University of North Dakota. It's a deep discussion. We talk about medically assisted death and dying with dignity. Sarah DeMonsigny is a 45-year-old mother of three from Quebec. She was diagnosed at age 39 with a rare inherited form of early-onset Alzheimer's. A former midwife, she became a prominent public advocate for expanding the right to medically assist in her death in Quebec. With me to discuss in our monthly conversation in Philosophical Currents is Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota. Jack, welcome back to Main Street.
I'm happy to be here, although this is a pretty heavy topic. So
this is a heavy topic, and it's good that we tip off our listeners about that. And I want to start with the big question that was at the heart of this woman's story. Do we have the right to choose how and when we die? And how do philosophers look at that kind of autonomy?
Well, that question is complicated because, of course, it depends entirely on what we mean by rights. You know, if rights are simply something that the state gives us, then some people have that right and some people don't. There are 11 U.S. jurisdictions that allow for physician-assisted suicide, and of course, it varies around the world. And so some people have that freedom while other people don't. But if you think about rights as a God-given thing, as a part of human nature, as what we get for being people that comes automatically because of dignity, because of choice, then the question is much more complicated because we try to discover rights, we try to construct rights, we try to figure out what the limits of these rights are. And I think that a lot of people are arguing that people have a natural right to choose their own death, and they're trying to persuade the government to allow that to happen. The government is very stingy about this, actually, and makes the distinction between what's called passive and active euthanasia. Active euthanasia is when the doctor actually kills you, gives you a shot, could put a pillow, you know, over your face and smother you, do all sorts of things that make you die. That's illegal in the United States. What isn't illegal in these places is what's called passive euthanasia, which is taking you off the machines and stopping from preserving your life. And the idea is that in the first one, the doctor kills you. In the second one, your body kills you. And so the doctor doesn't have responsibility. And so this sense of agency of who's responsible and how to hold people accountable for this action is central to the question of whether we have the right to it or not.
I didn't realize that there were that many U.S. jurisdictions that allowed assisted suicide, essentially. It takes me back to the days of Jack Kevorkian, right? When this was in national news periodically for quite some time. Jack, but when someone is facing something like Alzheimer's, where they know what's coming, the family knows what's coming, we in our family knew what was coming, the balance of personal freedom of our loved one, our friend, and then society's instinct, you talked about it just a moment ago, to preserve life. How is that balance manifested?
I want to step back and say that while we like to say that we hold life sacred, we don't. We send people to die all the time. We send people to die in wars. We send people to die after crimes. If a police officer is shooting at you and you're innocent, you're still not allowed to shoot back, right? So the sacredness of life is always qualified. And the question at heart is whether people have the right to consent to die themselves, whether people have the choice to end their own life. And that's what this debate in particular is about, because Alzheimer's disease, sometimes called the long goodbye, is horrendous to experience. It's horrendous to watch. And by the end of people's experience with it, they often forget their children. They forget who they are. They can be violent. They'll be scared. They'll be in all sorts of psychological pain, if not physical pain. And advocates for this sort of thing are interested in the quality of life in addition to the sanctity of life. And they're also interested in this idea of dying with dignity, that you want people to remember you, if you're the one considering it, you want people to remember you as you were at your best, not as a victim of this horrible disease and not as someone who doesn't remember you. The woman in the article that you referenced in the beginning of our discussion, one of the conditions for when she would die is when she didn't remember her children's names. And that seems like an important milestone to say that, you know, your greatest achievement in life and the thing that you love the most of all, you don't remember. And how painful must it be for the children to experience that?
She was in a place where she was making her decision while she still could, years perhaps in advance of when she couldn't anymore. What ethical challenges come with making an end-of-life decision before the worst part of that illness sets in, before the worst part of Lou Gehrig's disease sets in? What are the ethical thoughts that go through your mind, Jack?
It's easier to make a decision abstractly, right? It's easier to say, well, if I'm like this, I'd want to die. Or if I'm in this level of pain, kill me, when you're perfectly lucid. And then when the time comes, you will have your natural tendency to cling on to life. And maybe some life is better than no life. And you don't have the capacity to articulate that anymore. It's very hard to figure out what we're going to want in the future. And I this is a silly example, but I remember when CDs first came out, I thought, all right, well, you know, CDs would be great for classical music, but who's going to want a CD for hip hop, right? We can't predict the future. We don't know how things change. We don't know how our feelings change. We don't know how our experiences change. And many of our listeners will probably have created living wills or medical directives for their family to say when they want to be taken off life support system, or who takes care of them when they can't take their themselves, and what kind of operations they should assent to in the future if they're incapacitated. And so we all have to try to figure out what our sense of self is and where the limits of our dignity lie. But that's such a philosophical question. It's so abstract and it's so distant. You know as well as I do that at any age you're at, it's really hard to imagine yourself 10 years older.
Right. Yeah. And I want to think that I'll have my same mental capacity, my same thoughts, even relative to this issue. But is that even fair for my family? Because I'll be a different person 10 years from now, 15 years from now, or 20 years from now, God willing.
That's right. And who you are psychologically is very different than who you are physiologically. I think inside my body, I probably feel about 32 or 33 years old.
Not old. We're younger, Jack.
That's right. And I'm going to be 56 this year.
Right.
But as you get older, in your 40s and your 50s and older, your body starts to rebel against you. Your body starts to not be able to do the things that you used to be able to do. I saw a comedian who was on stage and he got on a chair to make a point. And he stood on a chair and he said to the audience, I know everyone over 40 in the audience just gasped and said, oh my God, don't do that. That's so dangerous, right? We don't know what our limitations are going to be. And so we want to give ourselves as much freedom to be as alive and capable and have as many experiences as possible. But we also need to protect ourselves from the inevitability of our decline. And hopefully that decline won't be so steep. It would all be wonderful if we passed away perfectly coherent in our sleep after a wonderful day. But most people don't get that luxury.
This woman was still living a fulfilling life. She was active. She's a grandmother, and yet she was also planning her death. How do we make sense of that paradox that we should enjoy life, but also maybe prepare to leave it?
Philosophy has been obsessed with the question of death since its inception. And many philosophers have argued that what makes human beings special is that we are what the existentialists call a being unto death. We are an animal that is aware of our own mortality. And because we are aware of our own mortality, our experience of the world changes. It's part of what makes horror movies interesting. It's part of what makes roller coasters interesting. It's part of what makes loving and having families and having all sorts of adventures makes interesting. The television show The Good Place dealt with that in its last season, where the idea that if everything was forever, there would be no more excitement. And so we always have to confront death in some way. The question is, can we do it in a practical way? Can we do it in a rational way? Can we do it strategically? And I think that that's the shift that we have to make in this discussion, which is, can we be strategic about our death? We can be strategic about our lives. I exercise every day. I try to eat reasonably healthy. I've started meditating. I do these things to have the best life that I can, to be strategic about the things that affirm life. But how do you be strategic about embracing your own death? And how do you be strategic about accepting the fact that you are going to not be capable of the sort of thing that you are now sometime in the future? There's a subtle moment in the article where they were interviewing this woman, and then they're talking about her partner, and then say in passing, and Susan was asleep in the background during this conversation. She was already struggling with day-to-day life. She had timers set up in her apartment to make sure she didn't leave the stove on. The stove was on an automatic timer to turn off if she forgot. She talked about going somewhere and being distracted by her cat and following her cat around the room and forgetting everything that she's doing. Her life is already very framed by her mental decline. And so the question is, when she is the most lucid, how is she going to deal with not just what's happening to her now, but the worst case scenario?
We're having a deep conversation with our great friend, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life at the University of North Dakota, and the host of the public radio show that airs right here, Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Jack, let's go back to something you mentioned earlier and talk about it a little bit more. Do we even know what it means to die with dignity? And it isn't the same for everyone, I have a feeling, what that means to die with dignity.
I'm not even sure we know what it means to live with dignity. I think that a lot of people have jobs in which they are treated without dignity. A lot of people have experiences with partners in which their dignity is undermined. And so we struggle with treating people well, empathy, advocating for ourselves, and having a vision of what makes life worthwhile. For some people, sitting on the couch and watching March Madness, you know, unfold and watch these outstanding athletes play basketball, that's an incredible experience and valuable experience. For other people, they don't like this idea because they want to be the one playing basketball. They don't want to be the one watching. They want to be the one doing. And so we're constantly defining what's valuable for us. We're constantly defining our priorities and what dignity means in our self-image and how we let other people treat us and what we put up with. dying is the process of losing ourself. Dying is the process of losing our agency and our ability to control ourselves. We can't control our environment. We can control how we react to it. And I think at the core of this is the are two separate questions. The first is, what do we want the quality of our life to be? And how do we want to be experienced by others? There are some things that may just be too painful for us, or too belittling for us, or too limiting for us. And we may say, life is not worth living anymore. The quality of life isn't up to my standard. And so I'm alive, but it's not a life worth living. And then the second notion of how we want people to experience us is this question of how we want our children, our friends, our partners, our coworkers to see us, to rely on us, to remember us. And certainly, I want people to remember me at my best, not at my worst. I want people to remember me when I was the calm, rational arguer, not the person who got angry and yelled at them. I want people to remember the classes that I taught well and not the classes that I taught poorly. What about those people who, you know, their children have to clean up from after them if they've gone to the bathroom in the bed? If your child has to give you a sponge bath, if a child has to do all these things that inverts the relationship, that the parent becomes the child and the child becomes the parent, and there are all these things that the parent has kept private, especially their bodily integrity and their sense of their weaknesses, they've kept this private, they've protected their children from these things. And now all of a sudden, they're completely vulnerable. How much is your child going to remember the strong you, the whole you, the loving you, the exciting you? How much is that new you, the deteriorating you, the dependent you, going to diminish you in the memory of other people? Those are the two pivoting questions: what we consider a life worth living and how we want other people to experience us. And those are things that require reflection and discussion and time. And one of the nice things about having this conversation is in advance is that you do have the time to reflect on it, and you can change your mind and you can revise your plan as you get older. The more we think about it, the more we plan for it, the more likely we're going to get it right, whatever that means.
Hard discussions to have with families, but certainly I think you're right. People should consider that. I've always wondered, Jack, what happiness will mean to me later in my life. And the example that rolls around in my head, forgive me, is that if I am happy pushing a jelly bean around a table for hours and hours at a time, my children may not be happy that I am doing that. And what makes me bring that up is then I wonder, with this idea of assisted suicide or topics like it, is there a concern about where this all could lead and that life might somehow be devalued with folks with dementia or other disabilities if they're happy pushing a jelly bean around a table all day long, for example, but others in the world, their family, aren't?
That's a tough call. And any method of deciding whether or not assisted suicide is moral is going to have to control for ulterior motives, for family anger, for
impatience,
right? Yeah. You don't want someone to be killed because you want their money, or you don't want to have a parent killed because there's unresolved resentment. I just want her out of my life. I just want this over. You need the decision to be about the person. You have to make sure that whoever makes this decision and confirms the decision and acts out on the assisted suicide is doing it for the person, the patient, and for the right reasons. And so what does happiness mean? Does happiness mean I'm not in pain, right? There's a long-standing debate that goes back to the very beginnings of Western philosophy, asking what happiness is. And the first definition that the hedonists came up with was happiness is a life without pain. And the problem with that is death is the ultimate absence of pain. And so hedonism seemed to justify suicide. And so they defined pain, they redefined pain to be the absence of pleasure. And so death is also the absence of pleasure, if you're not counting beliefs in the afterlife. And so death then becomes bad because you're not experiencing pleasure anymore. If you are genuinely happy pushing a jelly bean across the table, if all of the outward signs are you're smiling, you're giggling, you sleep well, you do whatever you do, then it would be harder to justify killing you in that instance unless you spent your life saying to people, intellectual pursuits, athletic pursuits, engaging with the real world is what makes my life valuable. And if I get to the stage of pushing the jelly bean, I am no longer me. And that's the hardest of all questions. When are you not you anymore? When does the quality of life shift become so stark that your very identity changes? And I think a lot of people would argue that the jelly bean pushing you isn't you anymore. And they would at minimum have to mourn that loss, even if you didn't physically die.
I'm wondering what the line should be between choosing death as a form of control or peace, or choosing it out of despair and hopelessness, which is what has happened in the article that we've talked about, really. And how do we know the difference between those two parts of our, I guess, inevitable future?
Those are complicated in part because we give moral value to hope in a way that we don't give to despair. We push people to hope, and we describe hope as a kind of virtue and a kind of righteousness. And so many religions are built on the concept of hope and trying to erase despair. But despair is a real human emotion, and it is felt by many people in the most dire circumstances. To look at a prisoner who is in prison for life, or somebody who's being tortured, to say, oh, just stop feeling despair, is to do more than just dismiss their emotions. It's to dismiss their experience and the value of them in the world. And so I think empathy is at the core of all of this, because when someone despairs, we have to stop and ask, what is the despair about? And is there any way to take that despair away? You can't just convert despair to hope. You can't just decide not to be in pain anymore. You can't just ignore the experience of your suffering. People can't do it. It's not what a human being does. And so while we often celebrate the achieving and the acting out of hope, we shouldn't let that sense of hope eclipse the real moral importance of that person who despairs. And the question one faces when one is despairing is, how does one get enough energy and to move forward, to try to change their behavior, right? That's, if you are despair and you are stagnant, you will always be in despair. And we see that with depression, right? This is why depression is such a hard disease, and why there's been so much effort to try to find cures for it, because a depressed person is stuck and can't move forward and can't do the things that they need in order to get better. And the best description of medications that I've come across is the idea that what an antidepressant is supposed to do is give you enough health so you can take care of yourself to get outside the depression. Medications don't cure depression. They give you the ability to act in ways that will itself cure the depression. And so the problem with Alzheimer's disease, the problem with Lou Gehrig's disease, the problem with other things is there is nothing you can do to change. You are helpless. You are a victim of circumstances, of your body, of bad luck, of genes. And you can't punish someone because they were unlucky enough to get sick.
We'll have more of our philosophical currents discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, and we'll review the news with Dave Thompson, and Matt Olean will have his weekly movie review. That's after this. Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, visiting with our good friend, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota. Our topic today is death and dying with dignity. Jack, as we resume our conversation, let's think forward now in how stories like Sandra's that we kind of used as the basis for our discussion, and people can read her story. It was in the New York Times. Her name is Demontigny, D-E-M-O-N-T-I-G-N-Y, if you want to Google her name and her story. How does this then become forward thinking and playing a role in shaping future public policy and ethical thinking when a story like hers kind of bubbles to the top and brings it to us to discuss?
We live in a democracy, and so much of public policy is influenced by what people are paying attention to. One of the jobs of an ethical media is to force conversations about unpleasant things so that people can make good decisions for not only themselves, but their fellow citizens. This again requires a certain kind of empathy. This requires recognizing that other people's experiences are valuable. We're having a lot of trouble with that right now in this country. We're having a lot of trouble accepting the fact that other people's experiences are important and that other people's decisions are valuable and that people who live differently than us still have good, meaningful, important lives. We're having a lot of trouble just caring about the suffering of other people. And so an article like this, which is long enough to give us a sense of some of Susan's identity and give us a sense of who she loves and give us a sense of what she is as a person, that is really important because it's compelling. It's emotionally gripping. It's allowing us to center our attention on her and her plight. And then we can do two things. We can, of course, enter into her perspective. We can ask ourselves, how would we feel if we were in this circumstances and what would we want? And that's, of course, you know, the golden rule, the idea of learning to value other people by stepping into their shoes. But there's a problem, and I've said this for years, with the golden rule, and it's as follows. The golden rule tells us that we should treat people as we want them to treat us, and that's often important. But I actually think that the rule should be we should treat other people the way that they want to be treated. That we have to pay attention to what someone else wants so that we can make the right decision for them. In our ethical education, when we're young, when we're struggling to empathize with other people, when we're so narcissistic that we exist in our own world, then the golden rule is a first step. But we have to be able to accept people on their own terms, and we have to be able to value the life that they've chosen. And so a story like Susan's in an important location like the New York Times and in a place like Prairie Public allows us to ask, how are we going to frame our community and our laws so that these people have the opportunity to make the decisions for themselves? There are some religions that are just opposed to assisted suicide, and that's fine, right? People are allowed to have the religion that they want. But in a democracy, one religion doesn't make decisions for other religions. And in a democracy, one person's moral values is only one part of the conversation in a discussion about moral values. It's why Jews don't go around demanding that butchers stop selling bacon, right? Because people make these decisions for themselves. And so here is a woman who is a full person, who is an agent, who wants to make this decision for herself. And the question is, what laws do we create that allow for the most freedom for individuals and the most dignity for individuals? And how do we construct laws about medical procedures that protect the patients from abuse, but also give them the most opportunity to act according to their own values? That's why some cities have different laws than other cities, and why some states have different laws than other states, and why there are some laws that are umbrella laws for the entire government. There's some things that we think are flexible and some things that we think aren't flexible. The most important thing is to get their attention, to have the conversation so that we can then start to make the laws. And as we talked about earlier, there are many places in the United States that have decided to move forward with these laws, and there are many places in the United States that have not. And this is a testing ground for what works and what doesn't.
As we wrap it up, Jack, and I just want to point out her name was Sandra, not Susan.
Oh, sorry.
For people who may be trying to Google her a little bit later, my guest has been Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. We chat monthly in a segment we call Philosophical Currents. Jack is the director of the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life at the University of North Dakota and a distinguished professor of philosophy. Jack, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us again on Main Street.
Thanks for trusting me with such a tough topic. He's smart like a doctor with a real good rep. And when he comes
home, he's relaxed with pep. He always gotta get... Support for Prairie Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages. Extra, extra, read all about
it. Gather round, everybody. We bring in Dave Thompson, our dear friend and longtime news director here at Prairie Public, to review the news on Thursdays, and that music's a hint that that time now has come. Dave, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig. Good to be here.
Dave, in the news for sure is former North Dakota Senator Ray Holmberg's sentencing. He's been sentenced to 10 years in prison for sex crimes. Dave, given your long history covering Ray Holmberg and his influence in North Dakota politics, how did it feel to you to hear this final chapter unfold? And how do you reconcile the public figure that you reported on with the man that was sentenced yesterday?
I'll be honest with you, it's very hard because Senator Holmberg had been in this legislature since I've basically been covering the legislature, and he was very powerful. He was the powerful Appropriations Committee chairman. He was that one person I found very easy to talk to. He was willing to talk to the press at any time. And this whole thing that has unfolded about the alleged sex crimes has just been really a shock to all of us. There are some of us who don't want to believe it, but he has been sentenced now, and he's been sentenced to more time than the prosecution had recommended, which I find very interesting.
I feel for you, Dave, because this is someone you had trusted over the years.
That's correct. That is correct. And yes, a very good source. And, you know, let's be honest, he was very good to work with when he was chairman of Senate Appropriations.
Okay, Dave. Well, we'll move on. Dave, legislation about tenure for college professors is spinning like a basketball. The Senate has defeated but has now passed a tenure bill.
Right. They defeated it to begin with, but it was brought back for reconsideration and then was passed. The interesting arguments on both sides of that one, those who support the idea of this tenure bill, you know, these tenure things going into the, you know, state statute, is that they believe the higher education is going to have to follow this. But those who oppose it says higher education is already working on tenure and how to handle tenure, and, you know, maybe we shouldn't get involved. This is one thing, Craig, that was very interesting in the debate and the reconsideration. State Senator Judy Lee of West Fargo, a longtime Republican, brought up something interesting in state history. And this goes back to the 1930s when Governor William Langer tried to fire 8 faculty at North Dakota State University. Out of that was created the Board of Higher Education to separate it from the executive branch. And she argues that also to kind of separate it from the legislative branch. And I don't think we've heard the last necessarily of this tenure bill. It'll be interesting to see what Kelly Armstrong does with it, our governor.
Speaking of the governor, he made a big to-do yesterday about an amendment now that's been offered called the bell-to-bell cell phone ban.
It's very interesting because there were 2 competing bills, one in the House, one in the Senate, that would have basically put restrictions on students using cell phone during school time. Now, basically, they come up with a plan they've introduced in both chambers to amend both bills that basically says a student cannot use a cell phone from the time the school bell rings to begin the day to the time that the school bell rings to end the day. So no use of cell phones in schools unless it's medically necessary or somebody has a dispensation. What the purpose of this is, as was brought at a press conference yesterday, is they want more socialization. They believe that although social media does have its good points, it's caused more frustration and anxiety among students because, as the governor said, it's probably easier to be bullied by cell phone than it is in person.
This bill might have some momentum, Dave. What do you think?
I think it does have some momentum because there was still a good share of both houses that want to do something about cell phones in schools, that there is really concern that grades are starting to fall off, test scores are starting to fall off, and part of it's because they believe that students may be too much addicted to social media. One more interesting thing that he said at the press conference, he said this is the most impactful thing that we can do during the session. And he said that from somebody who spent the first 5 minutes of his State of the State address talking about property taxes. This is how important they believe it is.
Dave, what should we look forward to next week in the North Dakota legislature?
Well, finally, I think we're going to get some movement on the property tax bill. You know, the House passed its version of the property tax bill, sent it to the Senate. There was going to be a hearing in Senate Appropriations. It was postponed. I believe it's going to be rescheduled for next week. It'll be interesting to see what kind of, shall we say, forces are at play on this one, because there are some people in both chambers who want to add more, you know, want to add farmland to this. And the bill that is in play right now just talks about primary residence. So that's one thing to really keep your eye on.
Dave Thompson and I review the news each and every Thursday here on Main Street. Dave, great to visit with you.
Thank you, Craig.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC. With a team of agents serving homebuyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513.
There's the fanfare. That means it's Thursday, of course, here on Main Street, and our great friend Matt Olean stops by the Main Street studio, joins us weekly to review movies. This week's movie is Nickel Boys. It's a 2024 historical drama, and it's a film about racism. Matt, welcome to Main Street.
Hi.
This film brings a poetic, almost dreamlike visual style, I guess, to the table here. How did you like it?
Well, this is the final Best Picture nominee that I had not seen. This will probably be the final review of any film that probably got an Oscar nomination in 2024. It didn't win any awards at the Oscars. Rommel Ross is the director. It's based on a book by Colson Whitehead that came out in 2019, and it's basically about a young boy, Elwood, played by Ethan Hawke, who is very smart, and he's going to go to, you know, an advanced academy for school training, is his way out of poverty in 1960s Florida. But on the way to the campus, he hitches a ride with someone who's in a stolen car and fleeing the cops, and guess what happens? He's an accomplice, gets sent to the Nickel Academy, the infamous Nickel Academy in the book. So this is a reform school for boys. They are segregated. There's black boys at the school. There's white boys at the school. And needless to say, the white kids get treated better. So it's essentially a movie about how Elwood kind of endures things at Nickel Academy. And it's the interesting thing about the movie is the director, Rommel Ross, decides to shoot it in kind of a POV way. That's point of view, Craig, for people that don't know what I'm talking about. So essentially, see the film mostly through what Elwood is seeing, okay? He's seeing the people at Nickel Academy. He's seeing the guy he gets the ride with. He's seeing his grandmother, played by Anjanue Ellis from King Richard fame. She played the mother of the Williams sisters in that movie, and she's very good in the part. And he meets a young kid named Turner, played by Brandon Wilson, who kind of befriends him there and tries to teach him the ways to get along there before he's released. But the POV view is really what people talk about with this movie. So it's almost an experimental movie, Craig. It feels like you're watching an experimental movie. There's a lot of interesting visual images that Ross uses. There's a lot of flash forwarding, flashbacks, images of race relations of the time. We see a clip of Sidney Poitier and Tony Curtis in The Defiant Ones, famous film, where they're handcuffed together on a chain gang, black and white man. Great movie. And so it's all seen through Elwood's eyes. And I'm sure you're going to ask, Craig, does this work for the audience? How does this work cinematically? I think it works in fits and starts. I was not as wild about this film as some of the critics have been. There's been some minority criticism of the film. A minority of critics is what I'm trying to say.
Sure.
Most critics like the movie. And I did like it for the most part. I like the visual style. I like the fact that Ramel Ross chooses a different way to tell a story. This is a very risky thing to do, to shoot a film essentially from Elwood's eyes. Now, we do see him eventually, played by Ethan Hersey, the actor. We see him eventually in some flash forwards and some scenes later in the movie at the Nickel Academy. But I don't know if this works completely as a movie. I found myself unable to, even though the content is amazing, it's horrible. Some of the boys are mistreated at the academy, as you can imagine, Craig. And so you want to get to the bottom of this. Like, are people ever going to be held responsible for mistreating these boys at the academy? But because it's point of view, you know, Ethan Hersey isn't really ever allowed to give a completely 100% performance, I don't think, as Elwood. And maybe it's because we're used to seeing everything shot from a camera, from the director's point of view. But I found myself unable to engage completely emotionally in the movie, and it's a long one. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes long. I would say it's an ambitious experimental experiment, kind of like Hitchcock's Rope in 1948, where there were no edits in the film except one to when they reloaded the camera. Sometimes these experimental films work. I give Ross all the credit in the world for trying something different, but it's an unusual way to tell a story. I'm not sure that all audience members are going to engage in it the way they're supposed to. So I would say it's kind of an ambitious semi-success, semi-failure, I would say. Certainly it's a film to be seen. It's an interesting commentary on the times, of course, when things were changing with the Civil Rights Act and the marches and things like that, which was all things that had to happen in this country. But I'm not sure I would have shot this movie the same way he shoots it, except I will say, you know, we've seen this story before. We've seen movies like this before told from, you know, 60s civil rights like Mississippi Burning and movies like that. So it's a new way to tell the story. I'm just not quite sure if it worked. I think it worked 80% of the time. But that emotional impact I was kind of looking for was a little lost on me at times. By the way, it is available on HBO right now if people do want to catch it. It did not get much of a theatrical release. Didn't make a ton of money either.
Matt, let's move ahead. We have a couple things to talk about before we get to the Oscar portion of our program, the Oscar trivia portion of our program. You just come back to life here with us here at Prairie Republic after the Fargo Film Festival. What's your take? What's your review? How did things go?
Well, of course, I'm involved in it, so I'm biased, but it was great. I mean, the crowds were amazing. I did a Q&A. I hosted a Q&A for a film on Carl Ben Eielson, a short film on Carl Ben Eielson, the famous pilot from Hatton, North Dakota, who died up in a frozen area of Russia in 1929. The theater was packed. I mean, it was a 10 a.m. showing, and by 9:40, people were streaming into the theater. So this festival has really grown over the years in terms of our crowds. It culminated with Molly Ringwald's appearance on stage on last Saturday night, so that was amazing. I think the big reason to go is to see all these amazing short films. I was on the documentary short jury this year, and no less than 3 documentary shorts that were in the Fargo Film Festival were on the Oscar Final 15 shortlist, including I Am Ready Warden, which got an Oscar nomination. So people love seeing these short films that you do not see in Cineplexes. You can't go see a 10-minute narrative short in the Cineplex. You can't see I Am Ready Warden. You can't see Hearts of Stone, an amazing movie by my friend Tom Van Avermaet, who's been to the festival before. He's a great European director. Another great narrative feature called The Strange Dark was amazing, directed by Chris Messineo, who came to the festival, and we got to be friends. So it's great meeting these filmmakers, actors, and actresses, and it's great to see short films up on the big screen, which is, you know, the only way these short films get seen is through the film festival circuit.
Congratulations on a job well done to everyone on your team and on the team that hosts the Fargo Film Festival. Matt, you have a Brando film series coming up. It begins April 5th, be 2 p.m. for the next four Saturdays, then at the Fargo Public Library. What do you have in store for everyone?
Yeah, so I do three of these a year for the Fargo Public Library. Lori West is my co-curator on these things. She works at the library. Yeah, we're going to run four Brando films that maybe not everyone has seen. So we're not going to run On the Waterfront, Streetcar Named Desire, The Godfather. We assume most people have seen those movies. Again, these are on Saturdays at the Downtown Library in Fargo. April 5th, we will have The Men, 1950. People think Brando's first film was A Streetcar Named Desire. It was not. It was The Men when he came off Broadway to do films, and it was directed by Fred Zinnemann, Oscar-winning director. He plays a World War II paraplegic war veteran struggling to move on with his life. It's a great performance. It's a short little film. Then on April 12th, we have Guys and Dolls, which was his only musical, and Lori really wanted this movie in the festival. You can come and see Marlon Brando sing, sing in quotes, alongside Frank Sinatra, his co-star in the movie. And then April 19th is Sayonara, which was kind of a big hit in 1957 about U.S. servicemen in Japan after World War II. And then finally, two Saturdays after that on May 3rd, we do skip a week in there. We'll have Reflections in a Golden Eye, 1967, directed by John Huston, co-starring Liz Taylor. And I think that's his most underrated performance of his career. He plays a homosexual army officer on a base in the South, in the southern United States. And it's a really interesting film. It's a strange film based on a Carson McCullers book. And Brando is excellent in it.
Let's pop to the Oscar trivia part of our show. Mm-hmm. Matt, at the 39th Academy Awards, 1967, a film about racism won the award for Best Picture. What was it?
In the Heat of the Night.
Who won Best Actor?
Rod Steiger as the sheriff in In the Heat of the Night.
Well done, Matt. We've been to the movies with our great friend, Matt Olean.
Support for PrayPublic is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy cooperative, producing reliable electricity for 141 member rural electric systems in nine states.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 27th. Howard and Edna Stout were thankful for their new baby girl born in 1949. They named her Linda. But soon they became worried because baby Linda wasn't thriving. She was very weak due to being born with a hole in her heart, a ventricular septal defect between the lower chambers. Linda's heart had trouble circulating oxygenated blood, which limited her growth and energy. Back then, doctors couldn't fix her heart and told her parents she wouldn't live long. In 1954, when Linda turned five, she had survived despite frequent infections due to her weak immune system. She had almost died from pneumonia a couple of times. One day, their local doctor said, "I've done all I could do. She's in God's hands now." Linda's parents contacted Minnesota's Mayo Clinic and traveled from Bismarck to Rochester, hoping for help. Mayo doctors were trying to perfect a heart-lung machine that could keep the heart dry during surgery. They said it would be ready in 2 years, and if Linda could survive that long, they might be able to cure her with open-heart surgery. The machine was completed sooner than expected, and Mayo doctors said they would like to use it on Linda. When Linda and her parents met Dr. John W. Kirkland in his office, he told them that Linda's open-heart surgery would be the first one ever at Mayo. Both parents were afraid to take the chance, and as Mrs. Stout later told Linda, "I wanted to grab you and run away." However, because Mrs. Stout was a praying woman, they decided not to run. Instead, she asked family, friends, and their church to pray for a miracle of healing. On this date, in 1955, a newspaper reported that it was Miracle Week in heart surgery, because the new heart and lung bypass machine worked. Linda's operation was a success. Dr. Kirkland and his team of specialists corrected Linda's heart defect. In September 1955, Linda celebrated her sixth birthday and attended her first day of school. She was joyful, saying, "If I hadn't gotten operated on, I wouldn't have gotten to be six, and I wouldn't have gotten to go to school." Linda gained more energy. She started roller skating, swimming, and ice skating. She grew up, graduated from Bismarck High School and Concordia University, St. Paul, and got married. Now, 70 years after her miracle surgery, Linda Stout Raisin lives in Ohio. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Steve Hoffbeck, retired MSU Moorhead History Professor. I'm Ann Ahlquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
And that's a wrap for Thursday's edition of Main Street. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we are thankful that you are listening, and we wish you a great North Dakota weekend. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with Jeremy Hobson. His topic is America Over Medicated. And at 7 p.m. Central on Friday, it's Science Friday with Ira Plato. We look forward to seeing you again Monday right here on Main Street.